Hi, Jacob.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Great.
Good. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV. This is The Wright Show. You are Jacob Heilbrun, editor of The National Interest in Washington, also author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons, if I've got the title of your book correct.
Absolutely perfect.
And relatedly, author of an op-ed in the LA Times earlier this month about how neocons seem to be exerting a fair amount of influence within the Republican Party and among Republican presidential candidates in particular, especially on the subject of Iran. So you want to start by telling us kind of what the thesis of that piece was?
Sure. Well, the common view in the last year of the George W. Bush administration was that the neocons were finished, that their reputations were buried in the sands of the Iraq War, that it was a debacle, not only militarily, but also for the reputations of people like Paul Wolfowitz, John Bolton, William Kristol. And my article said that, in fact, not only have the neocons returned, but they never even, in a sense, went away. They have spent the past years of using the Obama presidency and arguing that it's a failure to rehabilitate not only their reputations, but also the doctrine of regime change. And there, it's very, you know, when you look at their criticisms of the Iran deal, they're not really interested in criticizing or improving the deal. They want to kill it. And I thought it was very revealing that in his New York Times editorial, John Bolton, who was ambassador to the United Nations under George W. Bush, said, it's time for regime change in Iran. So here we are, back to the future.
Now, not everyone we think of as a neocon is quite that extreme in their expressed views, at least. I mean, some are saying, for example, Bill Kristol said he wants to kill the deal. And some of them are talking about bombing, maybe including Kristol, I don't know. And there's all, and we can always rely on Bolton to say something borderline insane. Some of the people we think of neocons are not quite saying all this, right?
That's fair enough. I mean, I don't think, I haven't seen anything from Robert Kagan arguing.
He's been very quiet about Iran, interestingly. And we'll get to that because you also wrote a piece in the New York Times some months ago about how some neocons may be angling to cozy up with Hillary Clinton and maybe succeeding. And he was a name you trotted out. So it's interesting he's not saying anything about Iran. And we'll get to that. But go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, the dominant tenor, though, if you look at Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas, who is a protege of William Kristol and of Harvey Mansfield at Harvard, I was talking to Les Gelb about this a few weeks ago, and it's a private conversation. But, you know, he said the neocons today, it's kind of amazing. He said there's a whole new neocon generation. And they exercise a kind of power and influence in the Republican Party that their predecessors never enjoyed. I mean, Norman Podoretz would fulminate in the pages of commentary and declare the end of Western civilization loomed. And Irving Kristol, you know, had his column in the Wall Street Journal and was publisher of The Public Interest. But there was they didn't have great political influence. And the amazing thing today, I think, about the Republican Party is that the neocon credo, whether it's in a more attenuated form or in a strident form, is really dominant. And there's really no room for the kind of realism or a more cautious foreign policy. I mean, you look at Marco Rubio, you look at Ted Cruz. You look at Jeb Bush, who repudiated James Baker because he was seen as too critical of Israel. There's no running room on these issues. The only one who tried tepidly to enunciate a different approach to foreign policy was Rand Paul. And even he has been signing on to anti-Palestinian legislation, signed the letter from Tom Cotton. So my own belief is that this has now become like abortion. It's these foreign policy issues like Russia and Iran are litmus tests. Mm-hmm. There's no wiggle room here.
Yeah. Now, and I think you're right about the history. I mean, neocons had never really taken over the Republican foreign policy apparatus until, even going into the Bush administration, you had Condi Rice, who was herself thought of as something of a realist. She was, I think she was kind of a protege of Brent Scowcroft. But 9/11 created this moment, you know, and there already were enough neocons floating around the administration to take advantage of it. But the 9/11 moment really gave them control of things. And then, you know, some people might think, as you suggested, that the results were so disastrous that they would, you know, that they would have been exiled. I mean, just to take one example, many of them would say that one of the greatest threats to America right now is ISIS. Well, ISIS seems to have been created essentially by the Iraq War. I mean, at least it's hard to, I mean, there was a group that kind of existed before that that became ISIS, but it's hard to imagine ISIS as we know it without the Iraq War. So you'd think that they would be off on some island doing penance. They're not. How have they done this? Do you know? It's remarkable resilience. They are like my role models. I want to be like them.
Right. David Bromwich, you know, teaches at Yale, emailed me and he said about the LA Times piece, and he said they are absolutely relentless. And that is a good part of it. I mean, we to look at the organizationally, and you the one mistake I think people make in, you know, you can condemn the neocons if you want, but you also have to give them credit for enormous energy and convictions. I mean,
when do they sleep, Jacob?
Well,
they're like rust. I mean, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you have the organizations. I mean, they've very deftly taken up the sort of organizations that existed during the Cold War and multiplied them. You have the Emergency Committee for Israel.
That's
you have
Bill Kristol's kind of
Foreign Policy Initiative, which is a successor to the Project for a New American Century, because that was tainted because of its pro-Iraq letters. So they retired that organization and then they created a new one. Mm-hmm. So it's really, it is almost like a perpetual motion machine. There's a lot of money behind it too, which shouldn't be discounted.
No, I see not.
We're facing, you know, it's interesting that a fairly small number of people can seize on these issues and have essentially captured a good part of the Republican Party.
Yeah, well, you know, there are a number of institutions in Washington now. I mean, how many think tanks are there that you would say are essentially neocon in their foreign policy orientation? AEI kind of is, right?
I think AEI is the most. But the interesting thing, what has happened, is that neoconservatism has become mainstream. Mm-hmm. Look at the Council on Foreign Relations. Max Boot, Elliot Abrams.
Right.
Brookings Institution, Robert Kagan. So this
and Michael Doran only left recently, and he's now at, I think, Heritage is it, or Hoover or something that's closer to truth in advertising. But you're right. There's like a sprinkling of them almost everywhere. And then there's things like AEI, Foundation for Defense of Democracies. I guess Heritage, I don't think of it mainly as a foreign policy shop. But the realists were exiled from Heritage, right?
Yeah. I mean, there isn't real, apart from the my magazine, there really isn't much of a voice for realism. And I publish both. We have a piece by James Goldgeier, who served in the Clinton administration, about Hillary's foreign policy. So we actually publish people on both ends of the political spectrum. But there isn't that much of a megaphone for realism. It tends to be the Brent Scowcroft, James Baker, Henry Kissinger generation, which is much older. And then in the Democratic Party, you have people arguing that Barack Obama has in fact taken over, that he represents the realist tradition today.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we might as well. Well, let's get into that in a second. First, before we leave this subject, and I should say, your Journal of National Interest is your magazine and web operation is, I think, the only foreign policy outlet I'm aware of that's fundamentally realist in its orientation. Although, as you say, you publish dissenting views.
But yeah, to be honest, my model is more of, you know, the New Republic that we knew, where you would publish, one person would say, we need an Iran deal, and the next person would say, no, it's complete bunk. Uh-huh. That sort of approach seems to me has dwindled in today's, since everything's so much more partisan. I find it more intellectually interesting to have violently clashing views.
It is. At the same time, one thing I notice is that, like, I saw this piece in Vox today where they interviewed, or yesterday, Michael Doran on the Iran deal. And he's, you know, quite far to the right. And we think of Vox as being this left-wing plot, right? And it occurred to me that, like, whereas liberal, you know, liberals, realists, and so on, like, when they run websites, they often do, you know, let a thousand flowers bloom. But it's like, on the other side, you know, you've got Weekly Standard, Free Beacon. I mean, they are, like, 100% dogma.
And they have an ideological mission. I think it makes it intellectually sterile, but maybe politically, if the audience is there and you're shaping the audience, maybe, you know, it's an ideological battering ram.
Yeah.
It's more, it actually harkens back, I would say, to the Trotskyist traditions of neoconservatism from the 30s. This idea that a magazine is an ideological weapon, mm-hmm, that can be used to crush foes and set the terms of the debate and you know, cast out the people who don't belong and so forth. It's not a market-driven approach, I don't think, as much.
No, seems to be working, though. Well, I mean, if you've got enough money behind you, you don't need to worry about the market.
That's right. Now, the one thing I don't mean to back up too much, but you were asking before about the resilience of the neocons. And the other thing is that they are almost Hegelian in their dialectics. I mean, the whole point about the Iraq War is they'll say it was not a failure. In fact, George W. Bush rescued it with the surge, despite
yes,
the pusillanimity of the congressional Democrats. Guess who bungled the surge? None other than the beloved Barack Obama.
Yeah.
He's the one that lost the Iraq War. I've had people tell this to me with a straight face.
Yeah, no, I know. That's the line. They have a line for everything. So let's briefly, before we get to kind of like Yemen and what a contemporary realist policy would be versus a neocon policy. On the presidential candidates, do you have a ranking in your mind among the Republican candidates? Like, who is the most neocon-y and who would be the most likely? They're all sound roughly neoconish, I guess, more or less. But do you have a sense for which ones are most assuredly going to keep singing that song if elected, and which ones might turn out to be a disappointment to neocons if elected?
The most pure, thoroughbred neocon right now is Senator Marco Rubio. He is absolutely down the line on all of these issues, Iran, Russia. He espouses the neocon credo, and he's very close to the Foreign Policy Initiative and to Crystal, and he has neocon advisors. So he is the, you know, your distillation of neoconservatism. But there are obviously others who are picking up elements of it, like Ted Cruz. Even Jeb Bush has Paul Wolfowitz as one of his
right,
senior advisors.
Although Bush has what seemed to be a somewhat diverse assemblage of advisors. But as you suggested, then when James Baker, who was one of them, kind of stepped out of line and said something about Israel that didn't meet with neocon approval when he was talking at J Street, he was, you know, rebuked by Bill Kristol, and not that long thereafter, Jeb Bush felt that he had to maybe not out and out denounce him, but stress his disagreement with him. And that's the kind of thing you're thinking about when you talk about the neocon influence over all the candidates.
The Wall Street Journal also had an article about Elbridge Colby, who is a fellow at the Center for New American Security and a Republican realist. The Bush campaign was reaching out to him. He even had a cover story in the National Review explaining why he didn't think Obama was actually a realist. The neocons essentially decapitated him. If you look at the journal article, they wield enough influence to just terminate people who don't toe their line. And he was being, you know, vetted by the Bush campaign.
So they basically just excised him from the Bush
yep,
campaign, in effect?
Yep. There's a whole story in the journal about it. Now, there are senior people like Bob Zelik, you know, the former head of the World Bank.
Right.
Who are, you know, the neocons loathe him, but he's probably untouched. He's too senior to knock off, though they will complain vociferously about him. I mean, the mystery is maybe Jeb Bush would be this moderate establishment guy. Maybe he would disappoint the neocons.
I suspect that by instinct, he actually may be. I suspect he's a little more like his father than his brother. I have no particular basis for
that. That's what we all think, but how do we know that?
Yeah, and will it matter? He's going to want to get reelected, and he's going to have to be somewhat obedient to the base.
Exactly.
So, and then just quickly, I mean, Ted Cruz talks a good neocon game for sure, but I get the sense that the neocons consider him a little too crazy to be trusted. I get that sense reading Jennifer Rubin, for example.
He's brash, and maybe he's not malleable enough. I mean, they'll go with whatever horse they have to go. They will be in a Republican administration.
Yeah, I guess I think they just maybe worry that he can't get elected. He's too crazy to be elected. Rand Paul, I think they just out and out don't trust. He can say all he wants at this point.
Right.
But by way of trying to please neocons, I don't think they're ever going to really trust him, and probably rightly so. And then there's Scott Walker, who I don't know if he'd even thought much about foreign policy going in, but he's saying all the neocon things, is he?
Yeah, though, there's people are unsure about where he would actually end up. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of ambiguity about Walker right now, but he is taking a neocon line rhetorically, but whether he really believes it or would act on it is an entirely different question.
And then any update on Hillary Clinton? As of a few months ago, you were seeing signs that she had a little bit of a kind of a neocon light orientation or something. And she was, I think, in fact, she may be the reason that Bob Kagan's wife wound up in the influential position she was in during the Ukraine stuff in the State Department. And in any event, is there an update on her? Is she sounding more or less neocon?
I don't think she's been talking about, she's been trying to, morph her image into a kinder, gentler Hillary. But yes, it's clear. There was a piece, actually, I was in London last week, and there was a piece by James Rubin, you might remember, was a high ranking official under Madeleine Albright. Yeah. And his piece was all about how terrible Obama is and how Hillary would be much tougher on Russia and she would be a much better foreign policy president than Barack Obama. So I think the Clinton people, they genuinely believe it. They are liberal hawks, and everything in her record suggests that she is as well. I think she would take a more confrontational line. And in the presidential race, she's going to want to insulate herself against the charge that Democrats are too soft to stand up to Putin, or that Barack Obama has ruined relations with Israel. I think she will move to the right inevitably, and she is instinctually a more hawkish person than Obama. My question is, will people become nostalgic for Obama's prudence? He's the only one that's arguing and stopping sending weapons to Ukraine. His whole administration is filled with people who want him to do it.
And even he sent some military advisors, didn't he? Don't we have?
Yes. I think
that was throwing a bone to.
Right. I mean, he can't do nothing. I mean, the whole Congress is, up in arms over what's happening in Ukraine. Now, if he sent weapons and if we really ramped up, that probably would play into Putin's hands. He could then seize upon that to engage in further military aggression.
Okay, now on to Yemen. Now, on the surface, our policy in Yemen would seem to make no sense whatsoever. I mean, in Iraq, we have a kind of de facto alliance with Iran in the sense that we are both fighting, supporting Iraq in the war against ISIS, whereas in Yemen, we are... we are supporting Saudi Arabia and other Sunni states like Egypt in a war against the Houthis, who have some degree of alliance with Iran. It may have been overstated, but some degree. And the Houthis that we're fighting are probably the most determined enemies of ISIS and al-Qaeda in Yemen. I mean, more determined than the guys we're supporting, probably. And so meanwhile, as we support this ratcheting up of conflict in Yemen, it seems to be benefiting al-Qaeda and ISIS in Yemen. So the policy makes no sense whatsoever. One defense of it that's been made, or an attempt to render it coherent, is that, hey, it's a classic realist policy. It's what realists call offshore balancing. We just want to keep anybody from getting too strong anywhere. So in this region, while on the one hand, maybe we seem to be kind of helping Iran and Iraq, it makes sense to counterbalance Iran in Yemen, and that's, so it's a realist foreign policy. Now, for starters, does that make sense to you? Do you think that's what it is?
I don't know. It may be putting too fancy a handle on it when they're dealing with events that are erupting and they're scrambling. I mean, look, aren't they just trying to make the best out of a situation that is a complete mess and has been, you know, the way I look at it is the Iraq war. You know, we pulled that the cork out of the champagne bottle, and it's been fizzing ever since. All of this is just blowback again and again. The whole Middle East, there was a piece in Washington Post this morning arguing that states are a thing of the past in the Middle East. We're just going to be dealing with these various tribes and sectarian movements, whether we like it or not. So, yeah, I mean, they are trying to prevent. I think your analysis is correct. Is that a realist policy? I guess, in the sense that it's as realistic as you can be under the circumstances. But I don't think it's a grand strategy. And it shows you how much of a muddle our policy is, because at bottom, my belief is we need some kind of rapprochement with Iran.
Yeah, well, the argument is, I mean, I think a lot of people think that what most terrifies neocons and Israel about a nuclear deal with Iran is it's not the issue that they think it would lead them to have a bomb. By any reasonable analysis, I think it is, you know, it's the best antidote to the threat of them having a bomb that's actually available and realistic. And that includes bombing, because bombing, just, you know, anything short of an actual invasion and occupation of Iran does not stop them from wanting a bomb if they want it. And if we bomb them, they'll definitely want it. So anyway, I think that's one reason a lot of people think that it is rapprochement with Iran that most terrifies a lot of neocons and Israel. And the fear is that a deal would lead to that. Does that make sense?
Exactly. I think Zarif, I wrote a piece in the Financial Times arguing for this, and the Iranian foreign minister Javid Zarif made the same argument in the New York Times yesterday. We need some kind of a detente with Iran. It's not an Arab nation. It's a Persian nation. We do have interests in common and stability in Afghanistan. Saudi Arabia is not all that reliable, or you know, they're less democratic than Iran. Right, there should be the possibility, if the reform movement in Iran is for real, if we can, you know, light, get these embers going, then there should be the possibility for perhaps an alliance even with Iran. Now, people are going to think that's crazy. They're supporting terrorism. But, you know, I would at least explore that opportunity. And it would not surprise me to have embassies exchange, you know, reopening embassies.
Okay.
This isn't going to happen overnight, obviously.
But. No. And right now, Yemen is complicating it pretty substantially. I mean, we have now brought a bunch of warships into, I guess we're creating some kind of almost blockade of Yemen to make sure that Iran doesn't bring any weapons in. They say they haven't been, but there is more and more kind of tension between the U.S. and Iran in Yemen. And, you know, I think, you know, you said, well, our Yemen policy just kind of happened. I think to some extent that's true. I mean, Saudi Arabia's, you know, an ally, and they started bombing. And so we're like, well, okay, you're an ally. There is some of that. I also think, though, that partly because of the domestic opposition to Iran, an Iran deal, and these accusations of appeasement of Iran and so on, I think all of that politically encourages the administration to be seen as making some kind of stand against Iran in Yemen. I think for them, that's a little bit of a political upside that could get dangerous down the road regionally there. But for now, I think that's a thing.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I wouldn't dispute that. I mean, that sounds perfectly right. But whether you can really create any kind of stability in Yemen, I don't know.
Well, they don't seem to be working on that very hard. And, you know, Iran is kind of asking for a ceasefire. I don't know if they can really bring the Houthis to the table. For that matter, I'm not sure we can bring the Saudis to the table. But But Iran is making these overtures, and so far, I gather, we haven't picked up on them, right?
Yeah. Well, it's a real proxy war. I mean, the interesting thing is, how far is Saudi Arabia willing to go in its mission against Iran? Because they are, you know, taking a much harder line than we are.
Yeah. Now, so there is this one way of describing this policy, maybe realist. One thing I forgot to ask you to do is, do you have a thumbnail definition of realism, or the kind of realism you espouse?
I mean, you know, I'm not that doctrinal because I have a journalistic background as well as having dabbled in IR theory.
Mm-hmm.
So I tend to be somewhat more opportunistic, though maybe that is realism. I think realism has become, it's become defined by offshore balancing and more by what it isn't than what it is. I think what realism, I mean, if you look at George Kennan, it's more, it's very wary of the idea of American exceptionalism, that America has a unique and divine mission to export its democratic values around the globe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, realists tend to be more pessimistic about human nature. If you look at the American track record over the past century, you know, this is where the neocons will argue that we are like the successor to the British Empire. We've brought all these great benefits to the world. But you can also look, let's face it, the Iraq War was a travesty, human rights violations, we engaged in torture. To me, it takes a good deal of self-delusion to believe that the United States is uniquely virtuous among nations around the world.
Yeah. And I think realism, in my mind, it also entails a tendency to not be too ambitious about your ability to intervene in the domestic affairs of other nations. I mean, you take what you got. These are the people ruling this country, and I wouldn't call it amoral so much in the sense of not caring what happens to the people within their borders as being pessimistic about our ability to influence that directly. And for that reason, there's a reluctance to make, you know, human rights reform and so on a prerequisite for dealing with people. I think there's also a belief on the part of some realists, which I share, which is that engagement, commercial engagement and so on, often is in the long run an effective pro-human rights policy compared to the alternatives. And so I think for that reason, there, you know, because one thing the neocons love to do is conflate the question of Iran's current human rights policy with, like, whether they can be trusted on a nuclear deal or what, you know, and so on. Whereas, well, you take my point.
If you go back to Nazism, which the neocons do, but it's the most extreme case, then yes, there is a point at which the behavior of a regime internally does serve as some kind of predictor for what it's going to do abroad.
And moreover, there's some point at which the atrocities are so egregious that anybody with a conscience would feel compelled to intervene.
But is Iran a revolutionary revisionist state at this point? Or has the revolution burned out and it's got a clique that's trying to figure out how to stay in power and stave off, the worst? I mean, that you have to make discriminations when you look at it. And China would be another example. It was a communist regime, but conservatives didn't really complain about its human rights record for the most part. They were more concerned about the Soviet Union.
Right.
So there are all kinds of contradictions. But yes, your basic analysis is right. Realists are pessimistic about reforming foreign societies.
And they're very mindful of blowback from military intervention. I think they've become increasingly so. I'm not sure that was originally part of the doctrine.
Well, realism, yeah, it is about power. You know, Morgenthau, I mean, at its essence, it's about wielding power, isn't it? So it doesn't, less than a left-wing version of realism, it's more receptive to deploying American military power. But I think realists would argue that these foreign interventions not only cannot help foreign societies, they can actually make the situation far, far worse, that it boomerangs.
Right. There's one other thing I would attribute to realists, and I think this is explicit probably in the writing of people like Hans Morgenthau, whom you mentioned. There's an emphasis on putting yourself in the shoes of all other players on the map, adversaries and allies alike, not so you can feel their pain, just so you can understand how they see the world and how they're likely to react to things. So, for example, when you're negotiating with Iran, you would be mindful of the domestic political constraints that they are acting under, and the fact that they have hardliners to please, and this is constraining their negotiating position, and so on. In the case of Putin, I think a lot of realists say we should have been able to predict some of the trouble in Ukraine, and that the, you know, the EU and certain EU initiatives and so on would be taken as threatening and so on. So there is this emphasis on putting yourself in the shoes of the other players, right?
That's correct.
So, is there a difference? You mentioned that there is a growing embrace by people on the left of something like realism. And yet at the same time, there's a difference you alluded to, right? So what is the difference between, I guess, your classic right-wing realists are like Henry Kissinger. It was thought of as a right-wing doctrine historically. But now,
if you look at Vietnam, I mean, Nixon and Kissinger, you know, were hardly shrinking violence when it came to deploying military power. The idea is that you deploy military power in concert with diplomacy. It's not an either or. Whereas for the neocons tend to regard diplomacy per se as rubbish, something that's a waste of time, or it saps your readiness to confront the adversary. So yeah, I mean, classical realists are obsessed with power, but with a balance of power, right? They're not trying to seek dominance. The examples of where people seek dominance, Napoleon, Hitler, it always comes to grief because of overreach. And that's what Paul Kennedy was driving at, right, with his book, you know, with the rise and fall of the great powers, which made such a big stir in, I think it was 1987. Yeah, it was before the Soviet Union fell.
Yeah.
He was talking about overstretch, you know, that you, by becoming grandiose, you almost become megalomaniacal.
Right.
And the realist critique of the neocons would be that they engage in the same mistake. You had the Wolfowitz doctrine after the Gulf War, where he says we need to become the supreme power. We need to block anyone, you know, whether it's Japan, Germany, China, Russia, from becoming a rival power. A realist would argue, and this is, you know, a liberal, you know, someone who believes in international institutions will say that this conservative vision is mythology, but a realist vision is of a balance of power, right? That all these great powers check each other so that you have an equilibrium of power. Mm-hmm. So that there's no one power can push the others around, and that this, based on, you know, the Westphalian idea, is what, you know, helped create peace for long eras in Europe, and that you transport this to the entire globe. So you have Russia as a great power, you have China, you have India, you have America. No one can push the other around, so the incentives for going to war are greatly diminished.
Right. Now there is, I think something's changed about the world that renders realism in need of some kind of amendment. And what I mean is kind of the rise of the non-state actor is a significant national security threat, like Al-Qaeda, or in the case of ISIS, a non-state actor that aspires to become a state actor, whatever you want to think of that. But the point is that both of them thrive on chaos. So, you know, sustained civil wars are places where they breed. And so whereas, you know, a classic realist, it seems to me, like, might look at the Middle East now and go, hey, things are going great. We're giving Iran a little help in Iraq. We're counterbalancing them in Yemen. So in this Persian Sunni rivalry, or the Shia Sunni rivalry, if you want to look at it like that, and I think that all that's a little overstated, you know, all of these kind of black and white worldviews are. But if you want to imagine a kind of emerging Shia Sunni conflict or whatever, hey, we're you know, the classic realist might say, we're keeping that in balance. Neither one's going to win. We're applying forces necessary. But meanwhile, in on the ground, you've got all this chaos in Syria and Yemen, where the closest thing to an actual adversary of the United States, you know, which is ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and so on, are actually flourishing. So it seems like it's not enough anymore to just worry about, like, balance of power among states in a really cold-blooded fashion, right?
I think that's right. I mean, I suppose the realist response would be that you can play off these, but you know, it can get too clever by half. You can't just neatly play off people. I mean, realism is maybe more of an approach rather than a prescription. I'm more skeptical of academic realism because I think these Baroque theories tend not to have all that much relation to the real world.
Yeah. I mean, I guess where realism would come in is like once you, I mean, realists don't like disorder, and I shouldn't be misleading there. They'd rather have order, generally. They'd rather the Syrian civil war not continue. I mean, even classic realists, right?
It's the Holy Grail. Order is the Holy Grail. That's all Kissinger talks about.
Right. So world. I shouldn't. So maybe everything I just said is misleading. But anyway,
no one's really figured out how do you deal with the non-state actors. All these theories were concocted or devised. Now, I suppose you could go back to the 30 years war and argue that these were non-state actors, but we are living in a different world. And that's where the Bush administration went awry, right? The idea was that you would change Afghanistan and Iraq, but Al-Qaeda was not a country. It was something that located itself in a country like a parasite.
Right.
But it wasn't the country itself.
Right. And like a parasite, it can breed and spread in ways that I don't think the administration I don't think they understood that trying to kill it in the most literal and obvious sense, like let's go over and kill those guys, actually spreads the virus.
Right, right.
I mean, what I would say on behalf of realists then, thinking of it this way, is that actually their instinct would be to stop the Syrian civil war, not so much on humanitarian grounds in an immediate sense as by virtue of their preference for order. And I think they would evince a flexibility that we have not evinced in Syria, which is that a realist would not say we're not even going to talk to the Assad regime until the Assad regime agrees that Assad is going to have to leave power. I mean, that's a demand that's pretty likely not to lead to any sort of successful negotiation. I think a realist would be perfectly fine saying, look, let's split up the country. Assad has still got this half. You know, let's... no preconditions. Let's get together and talk and see if we can cobble together a solution, right?
Yeah, and you can take it one step further. Realists would say the ultimate would be cut a deal with Russia. Give them this in Ukraine in exchange for whatever they can, because they do have influence with Syria. Bring in China and Russia.
Right.
Stop, you know, engaging in moralistic hissy fits about sanctions and all these other things. Cut the deals. Get it done. Save people's lives. Restore order.
Right. And order is, in and of itself, it's a humanitarian thing. Now, if it comes at the expense of freedom and democracy, then that's clearly a human rights downside. But, you know, order, the realist preoccupation with order has been ridiculed in the old days by people on the left. But all other things being equal, order is peace.
Yeah.
It's people,
I mean,
not dying.
That's what kind of peace, you know. You can have different kinds. You can have peace, which is an absence of war. You can have peace where you have a totalitarian power dominating a continent. You know, it's not, but
it's not everything.
Right.
And sometimes it's not worth preserving. The conditions under which it reigns are so severe, but it's, you know, not a horrible thing in and of itself, I would say.
Well, the old joke was that Hitler wanted peace, the peace of Poland.
Right. Yeah. That even your average realist would say that, order under those terms is not worth it. I think we've covered a lot of the waterfront. Anything else you want to say about, I don't know, life in Washington or neocons or realists or life in the publishing biz?
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, it's saying we have actually a new issue out, which I'll have to make sure you receive.
Mm-hmm.
It's a piece called Countdown to War, the Coming U.S.-Russia Conflict, which is by Graham Allison.
Sounds uplifting, yeah.
Dimitri Symes. And it, you know, elucidates what they see as the parallels to World War I, that we're not really fully aware of how this confrontation could spiral out of control. It's a very realist essay, again,
yeah,
about Russia relations.
Yeah, these things do happen. It's not an entirely encouraging time to be paying attention to world affairs, I got to say.
But there's a lot to write about.
There's plenty to write about, and that's good for you. So you wake up every day embracing the world.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, congratulations on that. thank you again, Jacob. So we'll link to some of your recent pieces. The LA Times, sounds like there's a Financial Times piece, although that will probably be behind a paywall.
Yeah, they're relentless about that themselves.
Yeah, but we'll still link and maybe get them a new subscriber or two. Your book is They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons.
Right.
And The National Interest is always worth reading. It's on the web. Doesn't have a paywall.
Nope, we never will, I don't think.
Okay, we'll hold you to that, Val. Well, thanks a lot, Jacob, and I hope you'll come back before long.
Thanks, Bob.
Okay, bye-bye.